For, well, seems like the better part of a decade now, we've just been surrounded by this narrative, right? This focus on the potential death of American democracy. You see it everywhere: headlines, books, expert commentary.
It's almost overwhelming. And you look at the political science out there, the books like How Democracies Die, or, the warnings from observers like Brian Clause. They document these patterns, these democracy killers in action globally, from Thailand to Hungary, and you can't help but see echoes.
Right. And those analyses are incredibly important. They really show us the symptoms, the ways things can break down. But today, our mission is a bit different. We want to shift the focus, move beyond how democracies die, and really dig into what allows them to survive. We're looking at the immune system, so to speak.
Because there's this surprising counter-narrative hidden in the data. It turns out that most of these dangerous populists, maybe only about a fifth of them globally, actually succeed in killing off democracy.
And this isn't just some academic thought experiment, is it? The stakes feel incredibly high right now.
They really do. Especially with the noticeable increase in political violence, the assassination of Charlie Kirk, for instance. It's horrific, and it brings back these really dark historical shadows. You think about Martin Luther King Jr., JFK, leaders during Jim Crow, even back to the Civil War era. It's a deep wound in American history.
And when that kind of fear starts permeating the political climate, you see potential cracks appearing, law firms feeling pressured, maybe media outlets pulling punches. It really makes you ask, is the US system fundamentally strong enough to handle this kind of internal pressure?
Well, the sources we've looked at suggest it might actually be quite a bit more resilient than we tend to fear. We've kind of distilled the analysis down to three main factors, these sort of shock absorbers for this system. First, there's the sheer scale of national wealth. Second, the longevity and complexity of its institutions. And third, a very deep-rooted legal tradition that empowers civil society.
Okay, let's unpack those. But maybe first, we should just acknowledge the threat that's driving this whole conversation, right? The sources are pretty explicit about certain authoritarian behaviors attributed to Donald Trump.
Yeah, they lay it out clearly. Refusing to concede elections, calling political opponents criminals, even suggesting they should be jailed while, backing violent supporters. And then there's that phrase, enemies of the people.
Chilling.
It really is. It
Right.
directly echoes language used by figures like Stalin, even Nazi propagandists like Goebbels.
Yeah.
That parallel is hard to just brush aside.
Definitely. But it's also interesting how, for a long time, the way academics study politics actually made it harder to see these connections.
That's a fascinating point. This disciplinary divide, where American politics was studied in one silo and comparative politics, looking at other countries, was in another. It sort of built this firewall that prevented applying lessons about democratic failure, or maybe more importantly, democratic survival, from the rest of the world to the U.S. context.
So once you break down that wall, what's the first big resilience factor you see? You mentioned wealth.
Right, wealth. It sounds maybe a bit crude, but economic prosperity is a huge factor. The political scientist Seymour Martin Lipset pointed this out way back in 1959, and he was drawing on ideas going all the way back to Aristotle. Basically, wealth helps sustain democracy. Rich democracies just don't tend to collapse as often.
Is there solid data on that?
Oh, yeah. Very strong data. Adam Pawarski did some landmark research back in 2005. He found that if a country's economy was richer than Argentina's was back in 1976, when its democracy fell, that richer democracy basically survived 1,000 years all told without failing, even through wars, crises, you name it.
1,000 years all told. Wow.
And a follow-up study kind of refined that. It found that a presidential system that had been around for more than 50 years and had a per capita income over about $23,000 in today's money, well, it had basically a 0% chance of failing.
0%. And where is the US now?
Our GDP per capita is currently around $86,000, so significantly higher than that threshold.
Okay, that sounds almost like a guarantee. America's too rich to fail doughically. But hang on, you mentioned Hungary and Turkey earlier. Aren't they both now wealthier than that 1976 Argentina benchmark? And yet we've seen serious democratic backsliding there. Doesn't that kind of blow a hole in the wealth theory?
That's a really important point, and yeah, it's a critical challenge to the simple version of the theory. But the argument is that those exceptions don't necessarily negate the rule for a place like the U.S. because of the depth and the spread of the wealth here. In really wealthy, complex societies, the commitment isn't just to, like, a particular leader or party. It's fundamentally to the rule of law itself.
Because losing the rule of law threatens everything else: property, contracts, stability.
Precisely. People across different sectors, educated workers, recent immigrants looking for a reliable legal system, they fear losing that predictable framework more than they fear any specific election outcome. And that vast wealth fuels something else, a massive independent civil society. Think about all the independent power centers. Big corporations, major law firms, universities, huge media conglomerates, nonprofits. Compare that to Hungary, where someone like Viktor Orban can effectively strangle opposition financially by controlling state contracts or directing all advertising money to friendly outlets.
You couldn't do that here.
It would be practically impossible. There are just too many wealthy, independent actors with their own resources. You can't choke them all off.
Okay, so wealth provides this kind of economic ballast and fuels independent groups. Let's move to the second pillar you mentioned, institutional design. It's funny because for a long time, people thought parliamentary systems were more stable.
Right. That was the conventional wisdom. Easier to pass laws, form coalitions, get rid of a leader with a no-confidence vote. Presidential systems, especially seeing the military coups in Latin America, often look kind of fragile in comparison.
But the threat has changed, hasn't it?
Exactly. The main threat today isn't usually a military coup from the outside. It's the elected leader who tries to dismantle democracy from the inside. And that's actually much harder to do in a presidential system.
Why is that?
Well, in a parliamentary system, the prime minister, by definition, controls a majority in parliament. The opposition often doesn't control any chamber, so they have very few levers to actually check executive power.
Like the Hungary example again?
Perfect example.
Yeah.
Orban won in 2010 with, 53% of the vote. But because of their system, that translated into a two-thirds supermajority in parliament, and boom. He could just rewrite the Constitution, start packing the courts, incrementally take control.
Whereas in the U.S.
The U.S. presidential system, yeah, creates gridlock. It can be frustrating. But all those checks and balances, a separate Congress, the possibility of impeachment, the sheer difficulty of replacing judges quickly, they act as massive speed bumps. They make it incredibly difficult for an aspiring autocrat to rapidly capture the entire state apparatus. It just slows everything down.
So the institutional complexity is actually a feature, not just a bug, in this context.
You could definitely argue that. It complicates life for anyone trying to consolidate power too quickly.
Okay, so institutional design is a barrier. What about the public? You need the people on your side, presumably?
Absolutely essential. And this is where the bar gets really high in presidential systems, according to the research. Kurt Whelan looked at 17 populist leaders since 1980 who seemed like serious threats to democracy in presidential systems.
Yeah.
Only two actually succeeded in dismantling it. And the key thing they shared, astronomical approval ratings. We're talking 80% or higher.
80%, that's huge compared to Trump's number.
Right. Trump's approval ratings have consistently hovered in the 40s. It's just a completely different league.
So who were the two who did succeed with those massive ratings? What did they do?
The classic case is Alberto Fujimori in Peru back in the early 90s. He achieved that 80-90% approval because he was seen as saving the country from two absolutely catastrophic crises simultaneously.
Which were?
First, hyperinflation running at 10,000%. Just imagine. And second, a brutal, devastating civil war being waged by the Shining Path guerrillas. He tackled both, and the public saw him as a savior.
Okay, that makes sense. Solving existential crises buys you a lot of political capital. Who's the more recent example?
Nayib Bukele in El Salvador.
Yeah.
He built immense popularity, primarily through a very aggressive, some would say brutal, crackdown on the country's powerful gangs. And also, interestingly, through relatively effective management of the COVID-19 pandemic, El Salvador's death rate was way lower, like less than a fifth of the U.S. or Mexico's rate.
So again, perceived success in a major crisis.
Exactly. And with that sky-high approval, he gained a supermajority, and then he was able to essentially purge the judiciary without much pushback.
So success requires massive popularity, usually born from crisis. What happens when they try it without that level of support?
Failure. Look at Jorge Serrano in Guatemala in 1993. He tried to copy Fujimori, do a self-coup. But his approval rating had tanked, down to around 20%. What happened? Massive street protests. The Constitutional Court immediately ruled his actions illegal. Crucially, the military withdrew its support. He had to flee the country.
And we've seen other failed attempts too, right?
Yeah, even recently in South Korea. An unpopular president apparently tried to impose martial law and it was just immediately blocked. The support wasn't there.
This really puts the U.S. situation in perspective. It seems unlikely that the kind of deep existential crisis needed to generate that 80% Fujimori-style popularity would happen here.
It's highly unlikely in an advanced wealthy nation. And frankly, Trump's handling of the major crisis during his term, COVID-19, didn't exactly boost his numbers long term. He left office around 34% approval.
Mm-hmm.
His attempts to, you know, perhaps manufacture a sense of crisis, like suggesting sending troops into American cities, those kinds of actions seem more likely to alienate moderate voters than build that kind of broad, overwhelming support.
And the sources also note he hasn't really expanded his base, right? He's lost some high-profile figures, hasn't made inroads into the center.
Correct. And actions like, say, pardoning January 6 rioters are actually deeply unpopular with the majority of Americans. Something like two-thirds oppose it. The simple math just isn't there for that kind of supermajority popular support needed for an autocratic takeover.
Okay, so if the political barriers and the popularity threshold are high, what's the final line of defense? The courts?
The judiciary, yes.
Yeah.
It's often seen as the last bulwark. And we've seen lower courts time and again block executive overreach. But the Supreme Court is, of course, the ultimate arbiter. And there's obviously a lot of focus and concern about its current composition.
Right. It's heavily conservative, dominated by judges associated with the Federalist Society, who generally favor a strong view of presidential power, this unitary executive theory. Can you just quickly explain what that means, practically?
Sure. The unitary executive theory is basically the idea that Article 2 of the Constitution vests all executive power solely in the president. So, in practice, proponents argue this gives the president broad authority to control the entire executive branch hiring and firing officials, even those meant to be independent, directing agency actions, interpreting laws, essentially concentrating power in the White House.
Okay, so that sounds like it could lean towards enabling a president who wants to push boundaries.
It can certainly lead to decisions that expand presidential power, like allowing presidents to more easily remove agency heads or bypass certain administrative procedures. We've seen rulings reflecting that view.
And this seems crucial based on our sources. There's a distinction made between a Federalist Society court and a purely Trumpist court.
Exactly. That's a critical nuance. While the judges share a conservative legal philosophy, often favoring executive power in principle, they aren't necessarily beholden to Trump personally or politically. Remember, Trump actually had a terrible track record at the Supreme Court during his first term. Lots of losses.
And crucially, when it came to the 2020 election challenges.
Those same Federalist Society-linked judges across federal courts and including the Supreme Court appointees consistently threw out those lawsuits. They followed legal process over political allegiance.
We even saw examples within the administration, right? Federalist Society members pushing back.
Yeah, like the acting U.S. attorney in New York who reportedly resigned rather than follow orders to drop charges, perceived as politically motivated. It shows a commitment to legal principle, even if it clashes with the administration's wishes.
Let's look at that big immunity case, Trump v. United States. The ruling wasn't a simple yes or no.
No, it was quite nuanced. It did grant presidents immunity for acts considered part of their core official duties. But Justice Amy Coney Barrett, in her concurring opinion, specifically pointed out that managing elections, things like assembling fake electors or trying to interfere with a peaceful transfer of power, is not considered a core presidential responsibility.
So those kinds of actions remain potentially prosecutable.
That's the implication, yes. The ruling carved out immunity for official acts, but not for actions deemed outside that core constitutional role.
And what about that really stark warning in Justice Sotomayor's dissent? The idea that the ruling could, theoretically, shield a president who ordered the assassination of a rival.
That was a powerful dissent. But even under the majority ruling, while the president might claim immunity for giving the order as an official act, however controversially defined, the ruling doesn't immunize the people who carry out the act.
Mm.
The Navy SEALs, the agents, they would still face murder charges. The system has fail-safes.
It's interesting how deep that commitment to legal process runs. You mentioned another recent Supreme Court case.
Yes, a really telling one about habeas corpus, this ancient legal right that says you can't just be locked up indefinitely without appearing before a judge to challenge your detention. The court ruled 9-0, unanimously. No dissents.
9-0 on what?
They affirmed that everyone, including non-citizens, deported under the old Alien Enemies Act and potentially held in foreign jails like Bukele's in El Salvador, still retains the right to challenge the constitutionality of the charges against them in a U.S. court via habeas corpus.
Wow. Even in a politically charged context like deportation and national security, the court unanimously upheld a fundamental right.
It speaks volumes, doesn't it? It shows the deep institutional commitment to core legal principles. Federal judges have life tenure. They think about history, about precedent. As Justice Gorsuch put it in one case, we're writing a rule for the ages. The idea that a U.S. president could just sweep aside the entire judiciary or rewrite the Constitution overnight, like we saw with Fujimori or Bukele, it's practically unthinkable here. The institutional inertia and legal tradition are just too strong.
Okay, that paints a picture of resilience, but we have to be realistic, right? The U.S. isn't without its serious problems. The system definitely feels wounded.
Oh, absolutely. We can't ignore the internal weaknesses. And probably the most significant one discussed in the sources is severe income inequality.
Yeah, the U.S. sits in a pretty bad spot on that Great Gatsby curve graphic.
Exactly. High inequality combined with really low social mobility, it's hard for people to climb the ladder. And you look at the statistics. Real wages for high school graduates, barely budging, like 27 cents increase over 50 years, adjusted for inflation. You see the loss of good jobs in many parts of the country, the rise in deaths of despair.
That kind of social fragmentation, that economic pain, it definitely creates fertile ground for populist anger, for people feeling left behind and wanting radical change.
It absolutely does. It's a serious vulnerability.
But does inequality itself inevitably lead to democratic collapse?
Well, here's where the comparative perspective is useful again. The sources point out that many Latin American countries that successfully resisted authoritarian attempts, think about Brazil pushing back against figures like Collor or Bolsonaro, they grapple with income inequality that's as bad or even worse than in the U.S. They have deep social divides too.
So inequality is a major stressor, but not necessarily the single factor that breaks the system.
It seems that way. It weakens the system, makes it more vulnerable, but other factors ultimately determine if it holds. Which brings us really to the final, maybe most crucial bulwark we haven't fully discussed. The people themselves. Citizen action.
The power of protest.
Exactly. There's some incredible research by Erica Chenoweth on this. She estimates that when just 3.5% of a country's population actively participates in sustained nonviolent protest.
3.5% doesn't sound like that much.
It doesn't, but historically it's been incredibly powerful. At that level, almost 90% of autocratic regimes have eventually fallen. Even getting just 1% participation has been enough to topple almost half of them.
And we've seen significant protests here recently.
We have. The sources mentioned the No Kings protest against Trump back in July. It drew an estimated 5 million people across the country.
5 million. What percentage is that?
About 1.5% of the U.S. population. By historical standards, that's significant. It made it the third largest protest event in U.S. history.
What's the mechanism there? How does protest actually work to stop an authoritarian drift?
It's about signaling, really. Mass protests make resistance visible. Concerns that might be private, anxieties people feel alone, suddenly they see they aren't alone. Millions feel the same way. And that visible, widespread resistance sends a powerful signal to the elites, the people with institutional power, in the military, in big business, the courts, the legislature.
It tells them.
It tells them that the status quo is becoming unstable,
right.
That supporting the leader or the regime is becoming risky. It encourages them to maybe stay neutral or even to actively withdraw their support. It activates that crucial democratic feedback loop.
So putting all these pieces together, wealth, institutions, the high bar for autocratic popularity, the judiciary, citizen action, what's the takeaway for someone trying to gauge the health of American democracy right now?
I think the main takeaway from this deep dive is that while American democracy is undeniably under stress, it's wounded, maybe even deteriorating in some ways, it's far from dead. The combination of factors we've discussed, immense wealth, the specific design of the presidential system with its separation of powers, that incredibly high popularity threshold needed for a successful power grab, plus an independent judiciary and a vibrant civil society, it all creates layers of resilience. These are layers that many democracies that did fail simply didn't have.
It really feels like the sheer weight of history plays a role too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Think about it as a final thought for our listeners. How much of the system's current strength, its confidence, comes from that incredibly deep legal lineage? We're talking traditions tracing back centuries, arguably even to things like the Magna Carta in 1215.
That long history, it imbues the institutions with a certain authority.
I think so. It empowers institutions like major law firms. You mentioned Perkins Coie fighting back versus Paul Weiss, maybe buckling under pressure earlier. It empowers media outlets like ABC standing by Jimmy Kimmel when facing pressure. this deep, almost invisible historical context, this legal DNA. You can argue that's the real underlying armor protecting U.S. democracy, even when it looks battered on the surface.